Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door.
You are listening to the voice of Basil Rathbone reading The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, a page from this Sunday's edition of Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Each Sunday at 1, WRCA, in cooperation with the Poetry Center of the YM and YWHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings from poets past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. This week, our guests, by transcription, Basil Rathbone and Thomas Hornsby Farrell.
Childhood's hour, I have not been as others were. I have not seen as others saw. I could not bring my passions from a common spring. From the same source, I have not taken my sorrow. I could not awaken my heart to joy at the same tone. And all I loved alone. Then, in my childhood, in the dawn of a most stormy life, was drawn from every depth of good and ill, the mystery which binds me still. From the torrent or the fountain, from the red cliff of the mountain, from the sun that round me rolled in its autumn tint of gold, from the lightning in the sky as it passed me flying by, from the thunder and the storm and the cloud that took the form when the rest of heaven was blue, of a demon in my view.
Basil Rathbone reading Alone by Edgar Allan Poe, a poem which might well serve as an abbreviated autobiography of his life, for certainly very few men have ever known the aloneness in which Poe lived and died. He was born on January 19th, 1809, in Boston. Less than a year after his birth, his father disappeared. 2 years later, his mother died, and the child Edgar was adopted by John Allen, a rich merchant of Richmond, Virginia, who gave him a home and his middle name. In his brief 38 years, Poe lived a life of bright and dismal extremes. He is credited with the creation of the American detective story. His first volume of verse, Tamerlane and Other Poems, although published anonymously, was a noted triumph. Yet throughout the years, his many varied and brilliant writings failed to satisfy, to bring him any peace of mind. An unhappy, destitute wanderer, when he was 24, he married his cousin Virginia, who was 13 years old and tubercular. Upon her death, 10 years later, Poe collapsed completely. From that moment, it was only a matter of months until his tragic death. Insanely depressed, plagued by hallucinations, on October 3rd, 1849, Poe was found by his anxious friends in a Baltimore tavern, his face haggard and unwashed, his hair unkempt, and his whole physique repulsive. 4 days later, he was dead. On the Poe Memorial Gate at West Point are these words written by Sir Francis Bacon: "There is no exquisite beauty without some strangeness in proportion." Here is that exquisite beauty and strangeness vividly alive in Edgar Allan Poe's narrative poem, The Raven, read for you by the distinguished American actor, Basil Rathbone.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow. Sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. The silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more." Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce for sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door." Darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, "Lenore." This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, "Lenore." Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning. Soon again I heard a tapping, something louder than before. "Surely," said I, "surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more." Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door. Perched upon the bust of Pallas, dust above my chamber door. Perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird, beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore, "Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou," I said, "art sure no craven. Ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore, tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore." Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast, upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on that placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing further than he uttered, not a feather then he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, "Other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before." Then the bird said, "Nevermore." Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, "Doubtless," said I, "what it utters is its only stock and store, caught from some unhappy master, whose unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hopes that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven still beguiling all my sad soul into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease, reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er she shall press. Ah, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee respite and nepenthe from my memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh, quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest of the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes of all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul, from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor, shall be lifted. Nevermore.
The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. Read by Basil Rathbone on the new Cadman album, Poetry and Prose by Poe. A man is as tall as his height, plus the height of his hometown. I know a Denverite who, measured from sea to crown, is 1 mile, 5'10", and he swings a commensurate pen. The words are those of Robert Frost. The Denverite in question is Thomas Hornsby Farrell, our second guest on this week's edition of Anthology. Born in Denver, Mr. Farrell graduated from Colorado College, was an officer in the Air Service, and since 1926 has held a full-time industrial position. As Child Herald, he writes a column for Denver's 93-year-old weekly, the Rocky Mountain Herald, published by his wife, Helen R. Farrell. A winner of many important awards in the world of poetry, Mr. Farrell has written 4 books thus far: High Passage, Westering, Trial by Time, and his latest, Poems New and Selected, published by Harper Brothers. In addition to his poetry, he has also written a volume of prose essays titled I Hate Thursday. Of his work, H.L. Davis wrote, Ferrell knows the Rocky Mountain country better than anybody, so instinctively and intuitively that his increasing control of its symbols, past and present, has been less a search for directness in expression than what Mazzini called the march toward self-realization, to which mankind, consciously or not, is in the long run committed. Today, Mr. Ferrell talks to us of those Rocky Mountains which stand at the threshold of his Denver home. He speaks of them as a man and as a poet. This is Thomas Hornsby Ferrell.
These great Rocky Mountains are, of course, very young and inexperienced. They're having a hard time making a go of it. Already, three much larger systems of mountains have come and gone where these mountains now stand. I touch on this in one of my poems, The Prairie Melts, a springtime poem. A little too long to read at this time, but I'll give you just enough of it to suggest one of my profound convictions, that man, frail as he is always older than the hills. He has memory. He makes records of geological time. He can project his imagination far into the future. The spirit of man outlives the wasting of his material environment. Few lines of the poem go like this. The prairie melts into the throats of larks, and green like water grain begins to flow into the pinto patches of the snow. I'm here. I move my foot. I count the mountains. I can make calculations of my being here in the spring again, feeling it, seeing. Three granite mountain ranges wore away while I was coming here. That is the fourth. To shine in spring, to sunlight from the north. A mountain range ago the sea was here. Now I'm here. The falcons floating over. Bluebirds swimming four deeps of the blue. Spindrift magpies, black and splashing white. The winged fins, the birds, the water green. I've read you just enough of that to give you some sense of the long continuity that interests me. Yes, I like to use Western symbols, but not in a regional sense. But they are as universal as any other. A mountain canyon might symbolize the vicissitudes of life. When you're fishing for trout, as I always do in the summertime, you might sense the long, slow process of evolution. Perhaps your father taught you how to fish. But who is your father? Is he that man who brought you up? Is he God? Is he an evolutionary process? Has something endowed you with a spirit and imagination that can dream far into the future to a time when the very mountains themselves will have sloughed off to the bottom of the sea? I ask these questions only to suggest how near and accessible any symbols are if we want to use them. The poem is called Time of Mountains. So long ago, my father led me to the dark, impounded orders of this canyon. I have confused these rocks and waters with my life, but not unclearly, for I know what will be here when I'm here no more. I've moved in the terrible cries of the prisoned water and prodigious stillness where the water folds its terrible muscles over and under each other. When you've walked a long time on the floor of a river, and up the steps and into the different rooms, you know where the hills are going. You can feel them, the far blue hills dissolving in luminous water, the solvent mountains going home to the oceans. Even when the river is low and clear, and the waters are going to sleep in the upper swales, you can feel the particles of the shining mountains moping against your ankles toward the sea. Forever the mountains are coming down, and I stalk against them, cutting the channel with my shins, with the lurch of the stiff spray cracking over my thighs. I feel the bones of my back bracing my body, and I push uphill behind the vertebrate fish that lie uphill, with their bony brains uphill, meeting and splitting, the mountains coming down. I push up, though, behind the vertebrate fish that scurry uphill, ages ahead of me. I stop to rest, but the order still keeps moving. I mark how long it takes an aspen leaf to float in sight, past me, and go downstream. I watch a willow dipping and springing back like something that must be a water clock, measuring mine against the end of mountains. But if I go before these mountains go, I'm unbewildered by the time of mountains. I, who have followed life up from the sea into a black incision in this planet, can bring an end to stone infinitives. I have held rivers to my eyes like lenses and rearranged the mountains at my pleasure as one might change the apples in a bowl. And I have walked a dim, unearthly prairie from which these peaks have not yet blown away. But if the continuity of life dominates my poems, the transitoriness of life is part of the picture, too. What could we say that we could understand? You men and women, builders of these houses, you lovers hearing the conifers at night, you lovers making children for the houses, did you say to yourselves when reckoning the yield of gold per cord of ore, running drifts per cord of ore, stoping per fathom per cord of ore, filling buckets per cord of ore, dressing tailings per cord of ore, you lovers making children in these mountains, did you say something animals can't say? Did you say, we know why we built these houses? Did you say, we know what the gold is for? I can't tell. You and the gold are gone, and nearly all the animals are gone. It seems that after animals are gone, the green things come to houses and stay longer. The things with blossoms take an old house down, more quietly than wind, more slow than mountains. I say I can't tell. I'm alone. It's too much to be the last one here. For now, I hear only the yellow throats of deep mines crying to be filled again, even with little things like bones of birds. But I can hear some of the houses crying, which of the animals did use us better? And I can hear the mountains falling down like thunder going home. That, as I said, was a poem of transitoriness. But again, the dominant theme in my poems is the continuity of the human spirit. Mankind today is suffering enormous agonies, and it's natural enough for many people to feel that civilization is doomed. The feeling of imminent crisis, of catastrophe, seems inevitable. Yet we must never forget that mankind has many times survived stresses and ordeals of frightful magnitude. And we must remember also that nobody is ever willing to admit that any generation of men ever had to put up with worse times than his own. It's always a contemporary idea. What is very helpful to us, it seems to me, is a sense of time, a sense of continuity. Not only time and continuity as abstractions, but time and continuity as physical realizations in which the great power of love is always operating. Love, with all its miscarriages of cruelty, its byproducts of abysmal wickedness and degeneration. Perhaps you will experience some of these time dimensions and love dimensions in the poem I'm about to read to you called Words for Time. It starts out with a simple Western symbol of time and distance. In the old days, when the pioneers were coming west, they would tie a piece of calico cloth to the spoke of a wagon wheel, and some poor child would have to count the revolutions of the wheel to measure the miles. It's a far cry from that simple method of calculating time and distance to the jet planes of today and the Geiger counter, which measures atomic time through millions of years. But however we measure time, the remarkable thing is that we are here at all to measure it. The poem, Words for Time, goes like this. Ask a boy on his back in a track the buffalo cut, how long it takes that cloud to cross that butte. How many turns of calico tied to a spoke of a wheel make a mile, make a century? Ask dew on the oxbow, where did the century go? Ask lantern light on the butternut sleeve in the evening. Tonight, I was watching a jet plane lag behind the spokes of light. A hub of sunken sun was turning in the underwest behind the Rocky Mountains. The jet plane, for an instant of 12 mountains, held its own with a span of apricot sky, but lost to a fanning blade of chokecherry. Nearer, a snow-white, pitch-black magpie bird sauntered the west wind faster. What shall I tell the children about time? Children who never counted the sing-back sway of the shoes of a single-footer horse, surrey by goldenrod or pung by snow, but know the red light from the green and when to go and go and go so soon over and under the poles of the earth and toss the earth like a toy balloon. Shall I tell them time is countable repetition? Tree ring, heartbeat, ocean's coral accrual. Or shall I speak allegory? Time has teeth, forgives, is foolish, yawns, rubs like a river, is bald, is nick, is nurse, is pale avenger. Big time, small time, war time, your time. Hickory dickory Geiger time, the mouse ran up the isotope. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40. Where you are, you shall burn up in your hiding place or not. I'll say those things, for all those things are true. And I'll tell the children time is love, like a slogan to laugh at on a greeting card, like a one I love song made of daisy petals. Like bidding the mountains sloughing off to sea. Good wayfaring, my hills. Goodbye, goodbye. Let boys and girls grow old and die one day, well taught that time itself doesn't exist, where nothing can go faster than the light that let me love that magpie's wing tonight. Love of watching, recognizing, naming, knowing why similar ash of men and cattle leaves talismans that differ as a hymn might differ from an idle opal mine. And I'll tell them, no, I'll let them learn it. All constellations, benchmarks, citadels, continuing and lost and starting over, within a whisper, was it all right with you? Passion into slumber, into being.
Comments and poems by the American poet Thomas Hornsby Farrell for this week's edition of Anthology.